491.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. The following episode was recorded and produced for WVUD and our podcast listeners by me at my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. The opinions represented in this program by hosts or guests do not necessarily reflect those of WVUD, the University of Delaware, or my own political campaign committee. Episodes are available for download on Tuesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes or Stitcher. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it simultaneously from WVUD.org on Tuesdays at 12:30 p.m. Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFD Radio or like us on Facebook. This is the Arsenal for Democracy.
This land is your land. This land is my land. California. New York Island. Redwood Forest, Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me.
You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy, episode 332, recorded on November 8th, 2020. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me back on the line from Idaho is Rachel. Hello, Rachel.
Hi, Bill. Glad to be here.
So this week, because the election had just happened and we weren't ready to get into that or hadn't figured out what we were going to get into about that, we're going to continue talking about more historical topics and other things that aren't going to be affected by any news developments of the week. So let's talk about bicycles. So, Rachel, I know that you have become recently in the last couple of years not only a rider but a major evangelist for e-bikes. So we're going to talk a bit about that, and then we're going to talk about the history of the bicycle in the Second Industrial Revolution and kind of fit it together with some of the other topics that we've been going over in 2020. So, Rachel, let's start off by talking about e-bikes. What are they? What aren't they? What are their advantages, and why have you become this really passionate supporter of them?
Okay, so first let's start with what they're not. They are not an actual motorized vehicle. They are often built with like a hub motor that takes the power that the user uses when they pedal and just kind of enhances it, amplifies it. So there's a lot of like pedal assist bikes out there. And what I have is a class 3 e-bike, which means it can reach speeds of up to 28 miles per hour. That's with cranking it up to the highest pedal assist possible and probably with a downwind, a tailwind going downhill. But oftentimes I reach an average speed about 20 miles an hour. And so I use it as a commuter to get to work. I live 4.5 miles from work and I can get to work in about 15 to 20 minutes, depending on the weather and depending on actually like how late I am running for work. I'll crank up the pedal assist if I'm running a little bit late.
Now, is that, you got a bike path there for that, just for context for folks, or is that
yes.
like open road,
yeah.
or do you kind of mix it up depending on where you're going?
So to go to work, I basically have to cross a few streets, but there is a dedicated bike path. Boise has the Boise Greenbelt. It runs east-west, and it goes through actually like several different cities. So I could ride all the way to my hometown, which is about 30 miles away, if I really wanted to. That's pretty rare. I don't think I would ever really want to do a 30-mile bike ride, but I could if I actually wanted to. So I do have a dedicated bike lane. It does make life very easy. Over the years, development has happened, and so there's a lot of roads actually cutting through previously uninterrupted stretches of the Greenbelt. But for the most part, it's mostly dedicated mixed-use pedestrian bike transportation routes. I do ride on the streets every once in a while. Boise is not, it's somewhat bike-friendly, but there's a lot of stretches where people are going like 40 to 45 miles an hour, and there's a pretty narrow bike lane. So I try to avoid it whenever I can. It's a pretty okay city to bike in, but it definitely could be better.
Now, with all of that, as you've just described the situation there, the thing that was very stunning to me was even with that relatively limited bike infrastructure, how much you've been able to bike on your e-bike, especially relative to probably how much you were doing on a normal bike or might have been doing on a normal bike.
Yeah, I bought it in March 2019, and so far I've ridden almost 3,000 miles on it. And that is just basically 5 days a week, about 9 miles round trip. If I have something going on downtown, I live approximately 6 miles away from downtown Boise. So on days where I have work and like meetings or whatever, I have ridden up to 20 miles a day, which would definitely be much more of a challenge on a conventional bike. So I see it as definitely opening up the city for me and just kind of making it a bit more attractive. It's not quite as daunting to think about riding 20 miles when you know you have the pedal assist and you know you're getting where you're going really quickly, about 20 miles per hour. So it feels like less of an obstacle versus driving a car.
Now, before we get into the history, I know you had a few statistics you wanted to emphasize here for the listeners.
Yeah, so I think one major facet that makes e-bikes really attractive is just how it can make seniors more mobile. I know there's a big problem in the U.S. with older people driving, which could be very dangerous, especially as reaction time slows, vision gets worse over time, and our population is aging at a pretty quick rate. So right now, the proportion of Americans over the age of 65 is about 15%. By the year 2040, 1 in 5 Americans will fall into that category. So it just makes it easier for old people to get around. And research from the AARP in 2018 found that 90% of adults over the age of 50 drive themselves places, but 21% of people over the age of 65 do not drive. And that proportion climbs as people age. So something to think about is just how isolated our senior community is. And so e-bikes can help get seniors out into the communities, interacting with people. I know loneliness is a huge problem in the senior community. So if that community is more accessible and more open to e-bike transportation, it can just really facilitate the interaction of seniors with their community, especially in places where the alternatives don't look that attractive. Public transportation, paratransit, and ride hailing. So paratransit, you have to like order a van in advance. And sometimes that just doesn't really work out for seniors. There's no like ability to have spontaneous travel. So then that kind of contributes to that social isolation. And I know there's Uber and Lyft, but only 29% of Americans aged 50 and older have ever used those ride hailing apps. And the majority are unlikely to try them. So while it can be kind of an attractive mode of transport, I think the technological obstacles are just pretty significant for seniors. So a way to get seniors around would be those e-bikes. It helps keep seniors fit and physically active, which helps prevent problems later on. Joints are healthier for longer. Active transportation can prevent the onset of diabetes and heart disease. So it just improves the quality of life. I know a lot of senior health is related to falls, and so the more active the population is, the fewer falls that happen. And there was actually a study from a researcher at the Cleveland Clinic, where he found that the pedaling movement associated with cycling improves motor functioning in Parkinson's patients by around 35%. So they allow riders to move and pedal quickly without overexerting themselves, so they can really help seniors retain that active lifestyle. I think it's pretty well known that older people are, and the AARP in particular, is a really strong lobbying arm. So the fact that the AARP is getting more involved in advocating for transportation for seniors can just really make our community safer for everyone. When seniors are able to be pedestrians and cyclists and use alternative transportation modes in their communities, it makes it more attractive for cities and states to really look at their transportation policies and what they are doing to help create safe communities that are accessible to everyone.
So all of the sources that Rachel has just gone over and the sources that we're about to go over in this episode, as always, will be up at arsenalfordemocracy.com. But let's get into the history of bicycles. A lot of this is going to, I think, relate back to what we've just talked about. In fact, I was very surprised to discover through the process of researching this episode that in the 1890s, somebody invented what is basically the e-bike today. I mean, you know, I'm sure there's been some tweaks here and there to the technology, but in terms of the idea of like a pedal-assisted hub and battery type of thing that's charged by your own pedaling and then helps you with some of the, you know, more difficult terrain or distances, that was something that was come up with in the 1890s, even if it's only really kind of caught on recently. So there is sort of a long history here that was pretty fascinating to do the research for. So let's talk a little bit about the timeline here, and then we can talk about another group that was famously helped in terms of integrating into broader society and being able to participate in things. So in terms of the timeline, bicycles were created in a rudimentary form, pushed along by people's feet in the late 18-teens, and then it was repeatedly modified through the 19th century. Specifically, metal pedal bikes were invented in France in the early 1860s, which ignited an initial bike craze, or I guess it's called the second bike craze compared to that very early one. And that ended with the Franco-Prussian War, but the UK kind of kept the flame alive and kept working on innovations. The 1880s saw the rise of safety bicycles with chains and gears and less chance of horrific crashes if you kind of hit something the wrong way, like a divot in the road. And then pneumatic tires, which were inflated rubber instead of the previous solid rubber tires for bikes, were invented in 1888 in Britain, and this began what's known as the golden age of bicycles through the 1890s, or at least part of the 1890s. The reason that was an important development and then also changed a lot of policy stuff is that solid tires were good for dirt roads, which had been everywhere, but inflated tires were better for paved roads. So you can see basically a bit of a chicken and egg thing there happening, but essentially with the rise of paved roads starting to emerge, then the push becomes toward these pneumatic tire bicycles. And once you have pneumatic tire bicycles, then people want better roads instead of dirt roads everywhere. That gets paved, and that actually leads pretty directly to the rise of automobiles, especially in the United States, but also in other places, because the road quality was finally good enough. So a bit of a backfiring in some ways lobbying for that, but it's important to understand that relationship. The other final development here before we get into the Second Industrial Revolution discussion is that by the early 1890s, a popular design of bicycles known as ladies' bicycles had been created, and that really changed some of the dynamics and some of the social dynamics around cycling. So Rachel, if you could talk to us a little bit about the role that bicycles had within feminism. I will note here that we'd been planning to do this episode for a while, but the Australian podcast that we've sometimes referenced, Bunta Vista Socialist Club, commonly known as Bunta Vista, they did do a bonus episode recently for their paid subscribers that was about kind of the more comical side of the feminism and cycling discussion, with guys who are really ticked off about women's empowerment and the role that bicycles played in, you know, helping women get out of the house and then go meet boys. But we're not going to talk about that side of it. So, Rachel, if you could talk about some of the sort of more serious discussion around the emancipatory nature of bicycles for women in the 1890s.
Yeah. So like you said, that safety bicycle where it's the modern style, I think we've all seen pictures of those like penny farthing bicycles with like the comically huge front wheel and then the really tiny back wheel. So once you got that safety bicycle design with the two same size wheels and that drop frame or the step through frame that helped accommodate women's clothing, biking became like a pretty attractive motor transportation for women. And with that came a lot of change in how women were seen. So middle and upper class women were kind of relegated to the domestic sphere. They couldn't really go anywhere without a chaperone, and they were really discouraged from like being out on public streets. So with the advent of the bicycle, they could really actually leave the house and become more involved in their community. And this really increased their mobility and their freedom. And so I think it was really popular with middle and upper class women mainly. But there were a lot of inexpensive bicycles and then payment plans that made bicycling accessible to poorer women as well. And bikes were actually really big in the suffragist movement. Suffragettes embraced bicycles both symbolically and physically. There was a women's monthly magazine called Godey's And they wrote in the 1890s that, quote, "There is something women of every class have welcomed as a shorter road to freedom than wide, welcoming college doors or open gateways to the polls. In possession of her bicycle, the daughter of the 19th century feels that the Declaration of her Independence has been proclaimed." And Susan B. Anthony herself wrote in 1896 that she thought the machine, quote, "has done more to emancipate women than any one thing in the world, and that she rejoices every time she sees a woman ride by on a bike." This is from a Bustle article talking about the feminist history of bicycles. So also, bikes weren't just a great symbol. They were also a really practical way for campaigning and getting attention around the suffragist movement. English suffragists in particular would ride around on bicycles with votes for women banners in the 1910s. And they actually physically blocked motorcades with their bicycles to gather attention for their cause. They even had basically a limited edition suffragist bicycle. It came in the colors of the suffrage movement, and they had a medallion of freedom. And this was in 1909, and an advertisement for it appeared in the pages of the magazine Votes for Women. Also coming in with this movement of freedom for women also came a change in women's fashion. So before, there were the big, bulky dresses and skirts that really inhibited women's movement. And so some women did continue wearing skirts and dresses while biking, but often they would get caught in the chains and actually throw women off their bikes. So then you kind of saw the rise of cycling bloomers, basically. So sometimes they were quite voluminous, kind of a split skirt or a split dress that had separate legs or separate tubes for the legs, but they were still quite voluminous. But some women actually started wearing more like a legging style. So of course that was very scandalous at the time. You could see ankles and the shapes of women's legs at that time. So it really struck a rethinking of women and how I guess their fashion and modesty, the acceptable levels of modesty in women's fashion of the time. So it's kind of interesting to see how cycling kind of led to a change in the perception of women and how demure and modest they had to be in public.
One of the things, though, that emerges from this discourse is that it's very clear the way that bicycles were kind of an individualized thing. Although we can talk about sort of aggregate liberation, it was still happening on an individual level in terms of, a woman could individually now be able to go ride somewhere without a chaperone or whatever, get someplace without assistance and so forth. But, then you get to that question of the infrastructure being available. And as I mentioned, there were certainly people who lobbied in favor of improved road networks that ended up being used by automobiles. But that is one of the sort of more controversial legacies with bicycles, is the way that it prioritized more individualized transportation over some of the emerging forms of transportation in the cities, like horse-drawn streetcars and then electric streetcars, which were often their direct competition if you were in a city. Obviously, the situation is a little bit different if you're talking about out in the countryside. But in the United States, you might ask, well, why did bicycles, initially have this wave of popularity as they did in Europe in the 1890s and then die off? And the answer is because of automobiles taking off pretty quickly in the early 1900s, especially after, 1910 or so, while bikes became seen as a toy for children. And that view was never adopted in Europe. So you did have cars, obviously, in Europe, but you also continued to have a big bike culture there. The bikes did have a resurgence in popularity in the United States around 1965 to 1975 with the arrival of the 10-speed bike technology at the same time as the emerging environmental movement. But of course, then that was more of an individual interpretation. It wasn't like a policy thing coming down and saying we should encourage and facilitate biking and make it safer to bike. It was more along the lines of, with a few exceptions, we did an episode previously on Davis, California and the bike culture there. But for the most part, this would be people individually deciding for environmental reasons or health reasons or, you know, ease of commuting, that they prefer to, you know, use a bike, get to work by a bike or what have you. But ironically, again, because this wasn't really being supported at a significant policy level, that particular bike craze peaked in the United States before the oil crisis and fell off pretty quickly. Other sort of remaining things in terms of the timeline there, mountain biking technology and popularity grew in the 1970s and beyond. That's still pretty popular these days. And of course, then we've got the e-bikes now. And then maybe most famously for a while there, under Mao, the People's Republic of China government was pretty pro-bicycle. And that did continue for a while under like Deng Xiaoping and so forth, of just promoting, oh, everyone should have bikes. But now, of course, there's a lot more motorized road transport in China and other modes of transportation with various controversial effects. But let's talk about bikes in the context of the Second Industrial Revolution. So in some ways, this is happening in parallel. In some ways, it's kind of disconnected from that. And the interplay there I found pretty interesting as I was researching this. So as I mentioned, the second bike craze was in the 1870s. Then the big golden age of bikes and the third bike craze was in the 1890s. That is when the period that we've typically been talking about on the show for the Second Industrial Revolution. And for this section, I am mostly just relying on some stuff that I pulled together from Wikipedia, but it had pretty good sourcing and write-ups on a lot of that stuff. Bicycle manufacturing industry, one of the articles noted, proved to be a training ground for other industries and led to the development of advanced metalworking techniques, both for the frames themselves and for special components such as ball bearings, washers, and sprockets. These were basically useful, transferable skills outside of the bicycle industry itself. And they also served to teach the industrial models later adopted, including mechanization and mass production, later copied and adopted by Ford and General Motors, vertical integration, also later copied by the auto industry, aggressive advertising. As much as 10% of all advertising in U.S. periodicals in 1898 was by bicycle makers, lobbying for better roads, which we mentioned previously. And then additionally, bike makers adopted the annual model of change. They would come out with a new model of bike every year. This was later derided as planned obsolescence when it was adopted by General Motors, but this proved very successful for the industry. Other things to know, some bicycle manufacturers became car manufacturers, especially in England, where the English focus on cycle technology innovation had been toward three- or four-wheeled cycles already, with more comfortable seats, and then you power those cycles, and eventually that leads you to automobiles. And of course, there were motorized bikes pretty quickly that became motorcycles, and those were fully motorized as opposed to the e-bike pedal assist stuff that we talked about earlier. Some bicycle manufacturers had started as sewing machine companies because there was some overlap there and they could be converted. And then, of course, famously, the Wright brothers and a number of other bicycle manufacturers after them turned into aircraft manufacturers after figuring out how to make aircraft. There were some new jobs and activities created as a result of bicycles in this period. Bicycles helped create or enhance new kinds of businesses, according to one of these Wikipedia articles, such as bicycle messengers, traveling seamstresses, riding academies, and racing rinks, and their board tracks were later adapted to early motorcycle and automobile racing. Now, in some ways, bicycles don't really fit neatly with the rest of the trends of the Second Industrial Revolution that we've talked about over the course of our episodes in 2020. The surges in popularity almost seem, and in some cases directly were, counter-cyclical to the economic booms and busts of the period, despite how expensive it often was to buy a bicycle at the time. Individually run small business bicycle manufacturers are also basically the opposite of big monopoly corporations, and there were tons and tons of individual little, you know, one plant or practically home cottage industry bike manufacturers at the time. But one of the recognizable features after the 1890s boom in demand started to collapse was that there was a big oversupply of bicycle manufacturers. And this will remind you in some ways of the oil industry stuff that we talked about with overproduction of oil and overcapacity of refineries and so forth in the late 1860s, early 1870s. The result of that was that a number of bicycle manufacturing companies bought up all of their competitors to become gigantic regional or national monopolies or near monopolies in a process similar to Rockefeller's acquisitions that we discussed in our series on how Standard Oil's corporate model came to define the era. Perhaps the most important of these was the American Bicycle Company, formed in 1899 by cycle manufacturing tycoon Albert August Pope of Columbia Bicycle, who merged 42 bicycle manufacturers in North America to create that company and then kept acquiring more. He was that key figure in bringing those things we just talked about, like vertical integration, mechanized mass production assembly lines, modern advertising, and planned obsolescence into the bicycle manufacturing industry, which then led to exactly the same for the emerging auto industry not long after. There's also a discussion to be had, but I think we're going to save it other than putting some stuff in the notes, about the role of rubber and the sort of brutal rubber plantations, because that's important overall to the Second Industrial Revolution and then to the automobile industry after that. But I'm not going to get into that today just because we're running a little bit short on time here. There obviously was also a military application of bicycles, and that is another important factor in understanding the development of bicycles and various innovation and so forth, because we've mostly been talking about civilian industry up to this point. But there are a few notable things. First of all, the French army invented folding bikes as a concept, and the current design was patented by African-American inventor Isaac R. Johnson in 1889, and that's basically continued to be used for folding bikes ever since. But that originally was a military invention. Some militaries, like in World War I, tended to just use them for scouting purposes. But in World War II, the Japanese proved that you could have tens of thousands of bicycle infantry who could not only move very quickly around guys who were marching along on foot behind a truck, but you could also have them carry more gear than a guy marching on foot could. And they didn't require petroleum-based, fuel like your truck did. So that was, and you could also just confiscate them from the local population because they were already quite popular in Southeast Asia. So they certainly used it. Of course, famously, guerrilla forces like the Viet Minh in North Vietnam or in French Indochina used bicycles as cargo transport. They would break down their artillery pieces into pieces that were bigger than what a person could carry, but still small enough for a bicycle to carry. You didn't need to worry about having donkeys or anything like that. And you could just, you know, haul that equipment and then put it back together. And then, Rachel, the last thing we should talk about here before we wrap up, very briefly, is the U.S. Army Bicycle Corps, a short-lived African-American unit not short-lived overall, but their dalliance with bicycles was relatively short-lived, that occurred in the Mountain West, if you could just talk about that.
Yeah, so they were in Fort Missoula in May of 1888, the 25th Infantry Regiment. This was one of four created after the Civil War that were made up of black soldiers with white officers. In 1896, Lieutenant James Moss organized the 25th Infantry Bicycle Corps to test the military potential of bicycles. They undertook several short journeys up the Bitterroot Valley by bicycle to deliver dispatches north to the St. Ignatius area and through Yellowstone National Park. And they actually made a 1,900-mile trip from Fort Missoula to St. Louis in 1897. But ultimately, the Army concluded that while the bicycle offered limited military potential, it would never replace the horse. And then after that trip to St. Louis, the infantry returned to Missoula by train. So that's kind of interesting, a little footnote in history.
It is interesting, certainly, to hear about them riding that 1,900-mile journey, especially considering that you have managed to ride the equivalent of coast to coast on your e-bike in the past couple of years. I just found that particularly interesting. And of course, Fort Missoula up in Montana, in your approximate neck of the woods, regionally speaking. Well, Rachel, this was a really fun topic to not only hear about the current state of e-bike technology and some of the liberatory advantages that could have for a lot of people who haven't previously been into bikes so much, but also to hear about how bikes played a role in the feminist movement and played a role in the Second Industrial Revolution as well. So thank you so much for being here this week.
Yeah, this was a true pleasure.